Species.
Unite.
And I was like, what is wrong with this crazy guy? I'm losing my sight and he's telling me to stop eating steak. <You know>? But I had nothing to lose. And so when I returned to the city and I started looking in my fridge and my pantry, and I said, wow, this is the food he's talking about. This is all processed. And so 3 weeks after going to a whole food plant-based diet, my vision came back.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Novogratz. This is Species Unite. For the months of May, June, and July, Species Unite is celebrating plant-based eating with vegan nights. All that really means is we would love for you to cook dinner for your friends or your family or your neighbor and make it vegan. On our website, we have downloadable host packs with recipes, tips, information to make your vegan night all the more fun and better. So go to our website, speciesunite.com, and download a host pack. And you will be entered to win one of six $275 vegan gift baskets that are filled with all sorts of incredible plant-based products. We would love for you to join us in changing the way the world treats animals. And you can do so by becoming a Species Unite member. For a monthly donation of any size, you'll get all sorts of exclusive benefits, including access to exclusive content, outtakes, bonus episodes, updates, and news, priority access to Species Unite events, a copy of our annual newsletter, and a welcome pack from yours truly. Go to our website, speciesunite.com, and click Become a Member to join. This conversation is with Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams. It's a conversation from mid-pandemic last summer, since it's extremely likely that Eric will be the next mayor of New York City. We thought it made sense to share it again. Hello.
How are you?
Really good. It's so nice to meet you.
Pleasure is mine.
Thank you. I know you are really, truly one of the busiest people in New York at the moment. And so any time with you is incredibly appreciated. Thank you so much.
You.
Let's just get right into it because I know our time is limited. So let's start because you're on the front lines of the protest and because your perspective is so unique in what's happening right now and this incredible movement in this country and huge change. You were on the force for 22 years, but before that, when you were a kid, you were beaten by the police. Can you talk about that a little bit?
It's amazing that sometimes you are in a dark place and you think that you're buried, and when in fact you're planted. And there have been moments in my life when I was in those dark places. And only because of the dark place as a child that I knew I was planted and not buried, each time I was in a dark place again, I looked at it through that view that I am planted right now. And so back then, the first planting was viewed as a dark place, and I became so angry because the innocence of being a child, when you're 15, you have an idealistic view of the globe. And that innocence was robbed from me because policing was the symbol of safety and protection. And so I became angry. My grades dropped. My mother was wondering what I was going through. And probably from the age of 15 to 19, I was not the human being that I should have been pre-entering that precinct. And then I was involved in an incident where a young man was shot and killed, and a noted figure was killed by the police through a chokehold. His name was Arthur Miller. And out of that, of some civil rights leaders came to me and 13 other young men of color and told us they wanted us to go into law enforcement and fight from within. And I was horrified about that idea. But when I went in and saw what was happening, it came clear to me, Eric, you were not buried those years ago. You were planted. And it started this journey I'm experiencing now.
And when you were on the force, you did a lot for reform.
Yes. I started an organization called 100 Blacks in Law Enforcement Who Care. And we fought for police reform. We fought against the abuse of stop and frisk. We fought against police misconduct and how we policed in different communities. And we became real advocates for change in the police department. And I think that we ran a leg of the race, that the baton was handed to us by those who started that, and we are handing it off. And now I think this generation that is marching and protesting, they're receiving the emotional baton that we handed off. And I think they're going to finish this race in a very respectful and dignified manner.
It looks like this change right now that's happening is real. It's last. It feels like and looks like, at least, the lasting change. Is that how you see it?
Yes, I do. I see it as it's going to be a significant part. And if we use the analogy of a relay race, sometimes in the leg of that race, you have runners that will make up ground and give you a nice distance. But the race is not over. There's so much more we have to do, and we can't only use just this leg of it. This is an important leg. We're making more strides. This is probably the greatest legislative movement in the history of America in such a short period of time. But I'm sure when we finish this leg, these young people are going to have to hand that baton off to another group that is going to continue the reforming of public safety, health, social conditions. And this is just another leg in the journey, and it's far from the finish line.
It's a big leg, and it must feel incredible to have been one of the people who passed that baton and still are in the race, but to have run with it for so long.
It is. And it's so exciting. And I as I'm marching with so many young people, and I'm seeing the energy, and I'm seeing the innocence of dreaming and possibilities, because you know, the older you get, sometimes the weight of life sort of tells you more of what's not possible than telling you that possibility lies in everything. And I just get refueled when I'm marching with these young people, and I'm just seeing that they just believe they can do it. And that is just such a healthy, good feeling. And I thought years ago that we would never get here, just as many of us thought we would never see in our lifetime a Black man become president. It's just a real exhilarating and exciting time just to be alive here. God must look down favorable on all of us to be a part of moments like this.
I agree with you. It's just an awesome time in this country.
It is.
And so this year, like I said, I mean, you haven't stopped. It started with, and it's still going on, but you were on the front lines in the height of the pandemic and out every day and bringing food to neighborhoods, plant-based food. Talk about that a little bit and what that was like.
When this first happened, coronavirus first came to New York, I felt the same energy that I felt after 9/11. And so I knew that New Yorkers needed to see me. And so that's why I moved into Borough Hall and decided that I was going to set up a command center here, because I had to bring real supplies, real food to people. We were able to make connections from our sister cities in China to get PPEs here that we were delivering to hospitals. We were handing out masks to NYCHA, transit employees, frontline employees, because while the city and state was dealing with bureaucracy, I had to find a faster way to get these supplies on the ground to what I consider to be the first responders on the ground. But there was something else I knew. I knew people had to see their leadership. When I knocked on someone's door and handed them boxes of groceries and they looked at my shirt and they said, "You're the borough president." when I went to hospitals and handed them boxes of PPEs, those nurses and hospital employees said, "You are out here with us." People want to see their generals. They don't want their generals to send them into battle and say, "How was the war?" They want to know that their generals believe in them enough that they're on the front line. And I thought that was an important role to play. And I would like to believe that was part of the energy that was placed into Brooklyn, that people said, "He never left us. He stood with us. He was here with us. He exposed himself to this virus like we had to be exposed." And I think that that made some sort of form of difference in how we responded in Brooklyn.
I think it made a huge difference. And just to be clear, when you say you moved into Borough Hall, you literally moved in, right? You lived there. You like set up a bed and that was home.
Correct? That's so true.
that's a real general right there. I want to really talk about your story before all this as well, because I find it absolutely incredible. And I want to talk about when you had diabetes and what happened, how you changed, and now you're handing out plant-based meals all over Brooklyn. So there's the trajectory there.
Well, my encounter with this entire new journey, I thought my legacy in life was going to be policing, but now I know my legacy is going to be in health and showing families how to live a healthy life. That is going to be my legacy from some of the projects. And it started through another planting. I was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. I lost my sight in my left eye and I was losing in my right. I had permanent nerve damage in my hands and feet, and I had an ulcer, high blood pressure, high cholesterol. Just my body was breaking down, and I was not aware of that until I was out of the country, and I had, you know, serious discomfort in my stomach. When I came back to New York, I went to see my internist, who sent me to have my stomach and my colon checked. And eventually, when I came out of sedation, they shared with me, after looking at my report, that I had diabetes in the late stages and advanced stages, I should say. And that was the reason for the vision loss and the nerve damage. I couldn't even feel my right thigh. I thought it was just an old football injury. And hearing that, I just refused to submit to the belief that I had to be on medicine the rest of my life.
What actually happened? Did you immediately say, "I'm doing this my way"?
No, I said to myself, "You know what? You are an ex-police officer, so you know how to do investigations and you know how to read. So why not just first seek on your own?" You know, it started out just saying, "What is diabetes?" And since none of the five doctors that I visited could tell me exactly how I got it, I started on that pursuit. And then I was able to discover Dr. Esselstyn, Dr. Barnard, Dr. Greger, all of these amazing doctors that are in the space of disease reversal and using food as medicine. And when I went down to see Dr. Esselstyn, he started sharing with me what I could do to address my diabetes, my type 2 diabetes. And I remember looking at him when he was talking about, you know, to stop eating this, eating that. And I was like, "What is wrong with this crazy guy? I'm losing my sight and he's telling me to stop eating steak." <You know>? But I had nothing to lose. And so when I returned to the city and I started looking in my fridge and my pantry, and I said, "Wow, this is the food he's talking about. This is all processed." And so 3 weeks after going to a whole food plant-based diet, my vision came back. And 3 months after, my nerve damage went away, my high blood pressure went away, all of those things that traditionally was impacting me went away, and no medicine, and I just felt fine. I lost 35 pounds. My body really just took on an entirely new existence after going to a whole food plant-based diet. And they always told me that it was in my DNA because my mother was diabetic at the time. She was diabetic for 15 years, 7 years on insulin. Mom followed me, and after 2 months of following me, she was off her insulin as well.
Were you stunned in the beginning that how powerful the diet was? I mean,
yes.
Plus, people, even though, I mean, I know that you know that because you did it. A lot of people don't associate being plant-based with beating diabetes.
Right.
They just don't put the two together still, even though it's a cure. And then your mom followed in your footsteps. That changed her life, I'm sure. Oh,
yes, yes. And, you know, it changed mine because that was the same mom that I hurt emotionally as a child when I was arrested. And to be able to come to her now and, you know, alleviate her discomfort and just to say, you know what, mom, and I just want to be there for you. So, you know, we all have these personal narratives and these personal things that we want to overcome. We have internalized what we can't do. And we have to unlearn to learn. Because I was blown away when in 3 weeks, all of a sudden, I was told the diagnosis and the prognosis was there's nothing you could do about it, and it was proven wrong.
Was it hard, like changing everything you ate, or were you so motivated because of the improvements?
Yes.
Both?
It was, and that's a great question. It's hard, yes, but it is motivating. Although it was hard, I saw the results so fast, you know, and then I sort of settled in to the power of a healthy lifestyle. I learned how to cook. I never cooked before. My favorite meal was toast, and I would burn that half the time. I learned spices, the power of spices. I started to really study one food group at a time. So it was a lifestyle change and not a diet.
You have a lot of incredible programs that I want to talk about that you've really gotten behind and started in this city. Is this when you started to realize like, hey, healthy foods are not part of many communities and there is a racial injustice happening with food in this country? There's a connection. And even though people across the board in this country eat fairly unhealthy, there's a lot of neighborhoods where just access to eating healthy is pretty tough.
Yes.
And so did that connect when you started being plant-based and getting really healthy? Did you start looking more at why aren't more foods accessible?
Yeah, you know, and it's amazing, you know, there's a part of quantum physics that talks about things do not appear until you take notice of them. And when I all of a sudden took notice of what food did to me, harming me, and what food did for me, healing me, as I started to drive around, I started to see people differently and I started to go into communities and realize, wow, look at all of these junk food restaurants. Look at these children, look what they're eating. And then when I started to go to city agencies and realize, okay, here's a school where the primary meals for these children are unhealthy. So if these children are not getting healthy meals in school and they're not getting healthy meals at home, then when are they getting healthy meals at all? And I started to look at correctional facilities to say, what are we feeding inmates? What are we feeding people in hospitals? So if you're in a hospital for diabetes and then all of a sudden they bring you your meal and what's on that plate are the same foods that causes the diabetes, I started to say, we have to now do a drastic food policy change throughout the city. And that's why we pushed to ban processed meat served in our schools. That was the first layer, and there are going to be more layers that come with it.
Talk to me a little about the hospital program that you started at Bellevue. Hopefully the whole world is going to copy it. It's so exciting. And it's also in one way, really surprising that this isn't already happening in a lot of places.
No, that's so true. I mean, you know, right now we're at a bona fide certified duh moment. You know, it's like, yeah, what are we thinking of? And so it's a great program. Dr. McMackin is a rock star. She's the doctor that brought it to us. And we were able to build it out. It is a lifestyle medicine program. We have about 250 people who are enrolled. It adds another option to your health care. Right now, if you go to the hospital, they tell you you could have this treatment of surgery, you could have this treatment of medicines. So we're saying, why not give New Yorkers another option? Now we have an option at Bellevue, which I'm hoping expands to all health and hospitals. We have an option, you could have lifestyle medicine. Instead of being on medicine the rest of your life, here is a method that you can actually cycle off your medicine with your doctor's care and change your lifestyle to live a healthier lifestyle. And that is an option that historically has not been in hospitals.
It's incredible. And it's so necessary.
Yes. And it's an even bigger conversation if we want to acknowledge it or not. Our healthcare system is not sustainable. There's no way we could continue with 30 million Americans being type 2 diabetics, 84 million are pre-diabetics, spending 80 cents on a dollar of healthcare on chronic diseases, the loss in productivity in our jobs, the mental anguish, Alzheimer's, dementia. These are all food-related diseases. We have no other choice but to start to go in the direction of how do we have lifestyle medicine. And it's too expensive and it's no longer sustainable to continue to do what we're doing.
Yeah, it's not. How else did this change you when you decided I'm going to be plant-based from now on? And you really are incredibly healthy. You do a lot of raw too, I've read.
Yes.
But did it change other parts of you as well, or spiritually or in other ways? A lot of people, once they kind of really shift and start really taking care of how they eat, you know, shift in a lot of other ways as well.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. I agree with you, because you begin to, you know, you begin to really start exploring things more and you reach a point and say, wait a minute, if I have a physical anatomy, then I have to have a spiritual anatomy. And that spiritual anatomy can't be consumed by processed spiritual foods. And you start to find ways of healing both. And that's why I meditate. That's why I do a lot of internal healing. And you can't allow an overconsumption of you know, just processed spiritual food, because then you become spiritually obese and you can't have one part of you to be healthy and another part not. So it's a natural evolution just to change who you are spiritually as well as physically.
I agree. For me, meditation and veganism, somehow, when I look back in retrospect, I didn't really notice at the time, were very connected.
Mm.
The more I became aware, the more I became aware. And that's, and then it starts, you know, kind of rippling out into other parts of your life.
It does. And you can't, and you find you can't, you don't allow yourself to be around those things that are toxic.
Yes.
You know, and I found my desire to be around healthy things and remove myself either physically or spiritually from those things that are toxic and unhealthy.
And do you think that like between the meditation and the diet, living that way and then going through COVID and going through this whole year, something like moving into Brewhall to make it so it's not so stressful and harried and you feel nuts, but instead life feels really doable, I think.
I could not have said it better. And that really circles back to the whole policing piece, because my day these last 4 or 5 months, it has been extremely stressful. And I believe that in law enforcement, if we introduce a combination of incentivizing healthy food, of incentivizing meditation, incentivizing communication, mindfulness, I think we'll produce a better police officer. Instead of just being reactionary, they will start to approach these extremely high stressful encounters in a different way.
Right, where it's not so reactive, but people are responding.
Exactly.
And present. Yeah, I think that would be incredible. I think not just the police, but like these are the kind of things that should be in our schools. And, you know, we should be learning from childhood. So one last question for you.
but I've heard you talk about before that you have this 100 point list. And at the end of the day, if you don't have 100 points, it's a problem. I love that so much. Will you talk about that?
I think muscle memory is so important. And muscle memory is something that you do so much that it becomes a habit and incorporated into your life. We get up in the morning and we take our shower and brush our teeth. It becomes part of us. We could probably do it without even thinking about it. And so I wanted to find a way to give back and make it become part of my muscle memory and be intentional on doing so. So I created this 100 point list where I had to do enough acts and actions that would equal 100 points of giving back. Something as simple as holding the door for someone, I'll get a point for that. If I take the train and I stand up and let someone sit down instead of me, I'll get 3 points for that. If I buy a meal for someone that's homeless, I'll get 5 points for that. And so I'll add up the points at the end of the night. I look at my phone and see if I got 100 or if I got 70. If I got 70, I put $30 in the jar. And at the end of the week, I will contribute whatever the accumulation of the points I miss. It will go to some form of initiative. But the goal is just to build into my life a way of constantly giving back. Because I believe that our lives are like a banking system. If we don't deposit enough in, we won't be able to withdraw and we won't have the equity when we are in need. And life has been good to me. I've been blessed with a beautiful family, a beautiful son. And I believe if I don't continue to contribute into the bank of life, I won't be able to draw on it when I need it.
I think everybody should start doing this point system as well. Hey, as someone who lives in Brooklyn, I am so lucky and proud to have you running the show around here. Thank you, Eric.
Thank you
so much.
To learn more about Eric, the work that he does, and the incredible programs that he is involved in, go to brooklyn-usa.org. We will also have links to Eric and all of his work on our website, speciesunite.com. We're on Facebook and Instagram at Species Unite. And if you'd like to support the podcast, we would greatly appreciate it. You could do so in one of two ways. Subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to podcasts. And we're also on Patreon. It's patreon.com/speciesunite. I'd like to thank everyone at Species Unite, including Gary Knutson, Natalie Martin, Caitlin Pierce, Amy Jones, Paul Healy, and Anna Kollner, who wrote and performed today's music. Thank you for listening and have a wonderful day.